Everyone, welcome to the Senate Committee on General Government. It's April the 19th, 2005. At this time, I'm going to open up a public hearing on Senate Bill 471. Judith, tell us where we are.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. Senate Bill 471 requires state agencies to identify opportunities for improvement when presenting proposed budgets to the governor and to the Joint Legislative Committee on Ways and Means. It specifies the procedure for monitoring progress in making those improvements. We have received a no revenue impact on this measure, no word yet from fiscal. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Very good. Senator Morris, welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm here today to respond to questions that you may have in work session, if you desire, unless you want me to.
And we could do that. We could do that, Senator, because we had no one sign up. So if that's okay with the committee, I'm going to go ahead and close the public hearing, open a work session. Okay.
Good bill should pass.
Good bill. Yeah. All right. We're closing the public hearing and opening up a work session on Senate Bill 471. Now, you're ready for questions.
I'm ready for questions.
Mr. Chair, would you entertain a motion?
Is that okay with you? I mean, you don't have to answer questions. You can get a bill out. Yes. Proceed.
And this bill is headed to the floor, not to Ways and Means?
Correct.
Mr. Chair, I'd move Senate Bill 471 to the Senate floor to do pass recommendation.
Is there any further discussion? Seeing none. Should we just without objection? Are you okay, or do you want to vote? Without objection, then. So moved. Senator Morris, would you carry the bill?
I will be delighted to. Thank you, colleagues.
Thanks. That was quick.
Yes, famous.
Frank Morris, if you're listening at home, we're taking care of business down here.
Let the rest of the audience see how this process works.
Thank you. I can recommend we have this person that we're going to pitch.
Oh, okay.
She wasn't expecting to pitch until 4,
right.
And we have one other person on 2119 that has a 4 o'clock meeting, so
okay.
Open that one.
Sure enough. As a work session?
As a public
hearing. Right. 2119. Okay, close the work session on House Senate Bill 471, if I didn't do that earlier, and we will open up a public hearing on House Bill 2119 as amended.
Mr. Chair, members, House Bill 2119-A requires persons holding mining operation, or reclamation operating permits to file annual reports with the Department of Geology and Mineral Industries. It stipulates that the information that should be included in those reports. It allows the department to issue emergency operating permits and temporary operating permits under certain circumstances, and allows the governing body of the department to revise anniversary dates of operating permits so that multiple permits may be renewed at the same time, the same date, and directs the department to prorate permit fees accordingly. We have a no revenue impact and a minimal fiscal impact on the measure. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Judith. Gary, I introduce yourself to the record and proceed.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Gary Lynch. I'm the Assistant Director of the Oregon Department of Geology and Mineral Industries. And I'm here today to testify on House Bill 2119A, which was developed truly over the interim. I don't know if any remember that House Bill 3013 from last time, which got a little controversial at the end. One of the things House Bill 3013 did was say, let's look at some of the issues surrounding mining and farmlands in the interim. And we took that as an opportunity to say, let's make sure our statutes are ready to deal with some of the changes that may be made. And I think, without question, everybody agreed that more data was needed on this issue from all sides, for the industry, for citizens, and for policymakers. And that's the major portion of 2119. Section 2 is simply in there to allow us to change our billing at some point in time in the future should we do it. It'd be a one-time change. It's truly procedural, and that's all. It doesn't change anything. The key provisions of the bill are the increased data requirements, which will ultimately be decided by a technical review committee in the interim that agrees with both the farming industry, the mining industry, and citizens what exact data is best collected to allow us to make good policy decisions, whether it's on farmland or mine land or both. And then the final piece of 2119 allows us, under certain circumstances, to issue an emergency permit for aggregate mining, That's best described as, many of you remember the floods from 96, 97. Rock is a prime commodity to help deal with floods and the impacts that can be caused by floods. So we now allows us to issue emergency permits under those very rare conditions. And, also allows us to issue a temporary permit where there is a time-sensitive need, the pertinent natural resource agencies and the local land use authority agree, then we can issue a temporary permit and the information that is required with a regular operating permit will come in after that date. So again, it is fills a very small niche that we occasionally face, particularly in eastern and rural Oregon, where an ODOT contract will come up. A designated source can't make it for some reason. They need to switch sources. There's a rancher nearby. He can offer it up. There's no controversy, so that allows us to do that. It's a streamlining process. And then there is a tightening of the exemption to make it fair to the field. Certain types of excavations can be, what we're trying to prevent is somebody trying to get around the provisions of an operating permit to mine by claiming exemptions that really were never intended to be used that way. That, in summary, is 2119A. I'd be happy to answer any questions, and thank you.
Any questions for Gary? Senator Berger.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I guess my question would be, what have you done up until now when you had emergencies? I mean...
Chair George, Senator Berger, what we've done is issued, though, allowed that to occur without a permit. And that's why we're trying to fix this. In 97, 98, and a couple other instances, we see meander cutoffs of river about to happen, or bad things are going to happen if we don't allow the use of rock to be excavated near the site itself to stop the damage. It's something that we did. It was the best of a bad situation. We either allow the rock to be removed without a permit, or not allow it and let the damage to the resource occur. So we figure this is the legal mechanism that allows us to deal with that issue.
Follow up, Mr. Chair. And what about the temporary permit?
Temporary is a similar type of thing. There is a time-sensitive need, and that in no way allows the operator to get around the permit conditions. It says they will come later. Initially, if we talk with the land use authority, which is almost always the county, and they have approved the activity, and all natural resource agencies have been checked with to make sure that there's not something we're missing. We circulate our permits to all natural resource agencies. If something stands out and needs to be addressed, then we can't issue it. So, and there has to be a time-sensitive need. And again, it most commonly occurs in rural Oregon. These don't happen often, once or twice a year. A road project comes up, they need the rock. We have enough familiarity with our people who are on the field all the time to understand and use good judgment when that temporary permit should be allowed and when it shouldn't be allowed. And the ultimate criteria will be, distinguished in rule after the session should this bill pass.
Follow up, Mr. Chairman.
Follow up.
I'd just like to share with you that we worked very hard on the South Coast to get American Bridge to locate on Bolin Island. They build concrete infrastructure that requires aggregate. They are very threatened by people who do not want aggregate mining to proceed. They also have to barge, and we have a limited amount of money for dredging for our ports. I just want to kind of draw that picture for you so that as we go along in our efforts to economically develop Oregon, and particularly on the South Coast, we run into these kinds of roadblocks that are very, very serious. And I don't know if you want to comment on that, but since you are right connected to aggregate mining, I thought I would share some of the problems that I see from my district.
Chair George, Senator Berger, we understand that, and I think, and I might add, the industry supports this bill in its entirety, and we work with the industry and other groups in the interim to develop this bill. Aggregate is a fundamental building block of the state of Oregon. Without it, our economy would fail. I mean, because you will lose roads and we'll lose the ability to produce concrete. So this state will always need an affordable long-term supply of aggregate. And there will always be critics of mining, and there will always be proponents of mining. And what we hope we do as an agency, and why this data collection and this bill is so important, is I think it will start to show, it may very well show, that the impacts that are perceived for mining aren't necessarily a reality. And that's what you need data to to shatter the myth, so to speak. Okay. So I think we are truly understand that situation, and I'll be the first to admit that mining can cause some significant impacts if done wrong. And that's the need for regulation, and hopefully this helps that process along.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Senator Stern.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a real simple question. One of the significant amendments that were made to the bill in the House removed the basically the list of items that would be required in the annual report and substituted that with a rulemaking process. Can you explain what the rationale behind that was?
Chair George, Senator Starr, the method to our madness there was after last session and the travails of House Bill 3013, where there were strong sides taken by a number of different folks, they commissioned a consensus group in the interim, endorsed by the Joint Transportation Committee and the Governor's Office, to look at this issue. One of the things that became clear in that consensus group is that there's not real good data yet on what the potential impacts for mining are, both positive or negative, and how much disturbance really does occur. So the consensus group has gone very well and will carry over into the next session, or excuse me, the next interim. And what we felt in working with the industry was we want all parties to have an understanding of what those data requirements should be. So rather than us dictate them at this point in time where you might say they weren't quite ripe yet, we're not quite sure of all of them yet, we wanted to allow that to occur during the rule writing. And by establishing a technical advisory committee, that'll bring in the industry, it'll bring in citizens, it'll bring in other agencies, and I think end up with a better product.
So just to follow up. So the working group didn't participate in helping to draft the original bill, and when they saw it come out, they decided it would be better to have the agency go through a rulemaking process. And then the second part of that question is, what's the cost to that rulemaking process to the agency?
Senator George, Chair George, Senator Starr, we made the consensus group aware from day one that we were working on this type of bill. What it became clear is, as the consensus group moved forward, that when we initially drafted the bill, there were other data requirements we'd like to require, and we thought, well, a technical advisory committee, and the industry was really the ones who would want that as well, would be a good way to go. And in terms of the physical impact, and I think Judith said it best, that we consider it I forget the exact language I used in the physical, but it's a minimal physical impact to the rule writing session, to write the rules. There is certainly some expense, but it's easily addressed within current budget.
Mr. Chair, the agency, I'm sure, has gone through rulemaking processes in the past. Do you not have a figure that an average rulemaking process costs the agency?
Chair George, Senator Starr, not really, because it really truly depends on, I can go back a number of sessions back to 91 where we passed a bill regarding gold mining, and the rule writing exercise on that was thousands of dollars, many thousands of dollars. This one, I've been around, I guess, long enough now that I would estimate this is in the neighborhood of a few thousand dollars at most.
Thank you very much. I appreciate your testimony.
Thank you.
Gary, continuing with what Senator Verger asked, we have a problem in particularly this middle section of the Willamette with the tremendous accumulation of rock, and we've talked about this in the past. What we're seeing right now is these accumulations are building to such a level they're going to cause dramatic stream bank changes. And you mentioned a minute ago that you're hoping that this gathering data process is going to actually help us. Now, one question I have, and that is, where are we with the feds relative to getting back in stream to harvest? I know he's laughing at me right now, folks. Well, we're not going to do it. But is this data even going to be helpful to begin the discussion with them?
Senator George, yes. And yes and no. First of all, the in-stream mining or dredging that you're talking about is a very controversial subject right now. Even within the federal agencies, there's disagreements on what should be allowed and what shouldn't. I think the agency's policy is there are times for just what you're saying, it would be a good idea to scalp some of these bars and remove the gravel. We manage wildlife habitat similarly, too. It's not a pristine, pure system anymore. It has to be managed. And I would say that about the in-stream mining as well. Now, the in-stream mining regulations exist within DSL, so that part of it truly is within their purview. Where you get into the gray zone is between the high water mark and the two-year floodplain. That puts DSL and Dagami together in the regulation of that. And I think we have to look far more creatively and far more innovatively at what's actually doing, and so that we manage these systems because they are artificially constrained in their current form. That says to us, if we really want to restore some of these sites that were pre-law, then we have to allow some of that. We actually have a project in where we're working with the federal agencies on that. It will be a long, slow walk, I'm afraid, but that's where we are, and I would say everybody's well-intended on this, but right now, because the data isn't all that it should be, and this will help that from the two-year floodplain on, it really won't address the in-stream stuff at this point.
Very good. Any further questions for Doug Allen on this bill? Thank you very much. Now, we have no one else signed up. Is there anyone else who would like to testify on 219?
Yeah, I see.
Excuse me, 2119.
Okay. Oh, just in the nick of time.
Just in the nick of time. Rich Angstrom, Oregon Concrete Aggregate Producers Association. I apologize. Senator Morris' hat was bending my ear out in the hallway. The association is in support of this bill. This is a bill that will help in the mediation process. It allowed Dagami to collect additional information so that we, when working with our Farm Bureau brothers, that we can work through some of our land use conflicts. And it expands our ability to collect information on our from our members so that you have better information as policymakers when working on these kinds of disputes. There's some other small pieces of that for emergency permits and some other temporary permits. That's not the essence of the bill for the industry. Those are just housekeeping matters, but I think this will help move the process forward in mediation. That concludes my testimony.
Any questions for Rich? Okay, thank you very much. Committee, are you ready to move this bill? I mean, anyone need problems with it or whatsoever, we'll go to a work session if you know. Okay. I'm going to close the hearing on House Bill 2119A, and we're going to open a work session on House Bill 2119A.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Starr.
Move House Bill 2119 to the Senate floor with a due pass.
Senator Bruce Starr has moved House Bill 2119 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any further discussion? Senator Walker, are you okay with it?
I'm okay with it. I just read it over. Thank you.
Okay. Without objection. So moved. Would you like to carry this? If not, Bruce, I'll do it if you don't want to.
I'll carry it.
Okay, got it. All right, we probably have 10 minutes. You think we can work another bill?
Maybe just the change of the name.
Okay, very good. Okay, we're going to open up a public hearing on House Bill 2053 with the tap of the gavel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. House Bill 2053 changes the name of the Oregon Commission for Voluntary Action and Service to Oregon Volunteers Commission for Voluntary Action and Service. It increases the commission membership as well. We have received a no revenue and a no fiscal impact on the measure.
Okay, we're trying to move right along. We have Ralph Brown and John Fletcher. You guys come on up here. We'll get started.
Thank you, Vice Chair, Senator George, and members of the committee. I'll start. I'm John Fletcher. I'm a senior policy advisor for Oregon Housing and Community Services. And the Oregon Commission for Voluntary Action and Service is housed within our department. So I'm here representing our director, Mr. Bob Repine, who's in Washington, D.C. today. And I'd just like to say a few things about the bill. The bill accomplishes two small things, but they're important things. First, the name of the commission is changed, and it seems like we're extending the name and making it more cumbersome and longer. But in fact, it's a way of having our cake and eating it too. Currently, we have a name that's starting to gain some familiarity around the state, and the name's been changed a couple of times, but at least now people are starting to understand what the Oregon Commission for Voluntary Action and Service is. We don't want to lose what we've gained, but yet we need a nickname and a shorter name. And by using the legal name of Oregon Volunteers Commission for Voluntary Action and Service, we can start to transition to the smaller nickname of Oregon Volunteers without losing what we've built. It's a legal maneuver, and it seems a little bit cumbersome, but after strategizing different ways and looking at what other states are doing to shorten their names, this was the preferred method that the commission decided to do to help the name recognition of the commission. The second change the bill creates is that it changes the required membership of the commission and adds two members. The reason that we're doing this is to bring the commission into compliance with federal regulations for the Voluntary Action Commission. The two members would add a participant in a national service organization as well as an official representative of a national service organization. We're doing this to be in compliance, and so it's a necessary change in the statute that was missed when the commission was created a few sessions ago. With that, we have a commission member here that can speak maybe to more of this, but that concludes my testimony.
Okay. Any questions for John? Ralph, go ahead.
Okay. Chair George and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Ralph Brown. I'm the chair of the Oregon Commission for Voluntary Action and Service. I appreciate the opportunity to represent my fellow commissioners today as I speak in support of House Bill 2053. The Oregon Commission for Voluntary Action and Service is housed within the Housing and Community Services. We came into statute in 2001. We have our own executive director, Kathleen Joy, who is sitting back here, and all of our commissioners are appointed by the governor and confirmed by the Senate. There are two primary reasons for requesting this bill. First and foremost is our desire to align the state statute with federal requirements for commission membership. All states are required to have service commissions in order to receive AmeriCorps funds and learn and serve money. The more than $2.75 million coming to the state through our commission and through the Oregon Department of Education are critical dollars funding capacity building in the communities across the state. In light of the federal requirement, it is important that our state-mandated commission positions are in alignment with the federal enabling legislation. When our legislation was passed in 2001, we inadvertently committed two positions that are required by federal law. The correction will bring us into compliance with federal requirements. The second reason for this request is to change a slight change in the name of the commission. We have found that the name Oregon Commission of Voluntary Action and Service is cumbersome and not memorable. In order to develop a recognizable brand that will assist our statewide promotion and support of community volunteerism, commissioners recognize this, and we need a shorter name. So we're requesting the addition of one word to our name. Please note that line 6, we are adding the word volunteers to the official legal name of the commission. While it appears to make our name even longer, it will actually allow us to legally remain Commission for Voluntary Action and Service, but brand ourselves and be known to the public as Oregon Volunteers. Solve is an example. How many people know what stop solve means, but it's recognized throughout the state, and that's what we're hoping that we can do. So far, reaction to the shorter name has been positive. We are developing name recognition not experienced before. We also want you to know that many state commissions on our service have chosen to take similar route to easier name recognition. Serve Washington and Serve Idaho are our closest neighbors. Volunteer Florida is one of a dozen that have chosen that identifier. We recognize that there are minor changes, but they are important to us and the continuation of our work. We ask for your support and would happily answer any questions you may have about the proposed legislation or about our program.
Thanks. Any questions for Mr. Brown or Mr. Fletcher?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I guess I'm wondering, you said that it would allow you to legally remain the Commission for Voluntary Action and Service. Would you not plan to legally change the name?
It would. If I read the wrong thing, that was prepared for me, or I might have such it.
Okay, well,
we're going to be, our name we want to...
Through the legislature, you probably would want to legally change
it. Yeah, well, I think so. I learned that one summer.
So, and the other thing is, I don't see it in my packet, but somewhere I saw Oregon Volunteers exclamation point, and that had been suggested that you use that. I don't know where I saw that, but I know either in an email or something that I didn't...
Mr. Chair and Senator Verger, we did have a legislative concept at one time that had that exclamation point, and I think it was suggested by legislative counsel that that be removed, and that suggestion was reviewed by the department and by the commission, and it was found to be acceptable, so that was removed. So
that was removed.
Currently, this is how we would prefer to see it.
All right. I have a question.
Senator Walker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Brown, nice to see you. I did not know that you folks administered the AmeriCorps program. Can you just tell us, are we getting the kind of service and commitment from Oregonians that we'd expect to volunteer in these kinds of programs? Because I really like the AmeriCorps program. I just thought it was a tremendous opportunity.
Okay, Senator George, Senator Walker. I experienced the AmeriCorps program from two standpoints. I'm a sponsor of an I Have a Dream class along with my wife and five other people, and we use AmeriCorps people in the Forest Grove School District as our people working with our class. I'm also part of the commission, and we have 250 AmeriCorps people in the state of Oregon with a variety of programs, and it is a great experience, and as, quote, a boss of one of the programs, it is so exciting to see these people come into our area. My first experience was when a group came from New York because they wanted to come to the Wild Wild West and spend a year here, and they were disappointed that cowboys and Indians didn't greet them, but we were able to give them junior high kids, and that kind of matched things out. So, but it is a great experience, and we hope to expand the program because AmeriCorps does so much for so many people in our state that we couldn't do without it.
Ms. Chair, I just think that's wonderful. Some elementary student asked me the other day, they were doing a research project, and they asked me who my favorite president was, and I said John Kennedy, but, you know, I think that's more the age that I was. I was 10 years old, and you know, he talked about the Peace Corps, and ask not what you can, your country can do for you, but what you can do for your country, and I said that really gave me a feeling that, yeah, I can do something for my country. And that's what the AmeriCorps program sort of brings that back into focus. And so I'm glad to see that you have some active volunteers.
Well, thank you for your positive support.
Members, we need to make a phone call in just a few minutes on another bill. If it would be okay with you, Senator Starr?
Just one, quick comment. I just want to say welcome to one of my constituents, Mr. Brown, and welcome back to the legislature. And thank you for your service.
Senator Jordan, Senator Starr, it's nice to have a former student up in the Senate.
Was he good?
His dad was on the school board. Yes, he was good. Yes, he was good.
Members, does anyone have any problem with this bill? If not, we're going to open up a work session on it, and we'll move it out, and then we'll get to our phone call. All right, I'm going to go ahead and close the public hearing on House Bill 2053, and we're going to open up a work session on House Bill 2053. Pleasure of the committee.
Mr. Chair, I would move House Bill 2053 to the floor of the Senate with a do-pass recommendation.
Okay, Senator Vicky Walker has moved House Bill 2053 to the floor with a do-pass recommendation. I'm going to do that without objection. So moved. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
All right. Then you're going to carry it.
Sure.
Okay, you have your speech written.
Right? I have my speech already written. Thank you.
All right. And we want to open on?
2030.
Oh, see, you did the same thing I did. You mean 2030. All right, we're going to open up a public hearing on that, or right. We did a hearing on before. Okay, I'm going to open up a public hearing on House Bill 2030 as amended in the House, and with that, we're going to actually dial in and have a conversation with another person here. So can you read that?
Yeah, and just so the members know, we're pitching in Deb DeLong, who works for the county clerks, who would like to comment on this measure. She's in a remote location that is apparently hard to reach by phone, so she should be waiting by her remote location now.
So she's not on vacation in Hawaii or someplace.
I don't believe so.
We'll get yelled at for that phone call.
County Clerk's Office, Debbie speaking.
Oh, Ms. DeLong?
Yes.
Oh, hello. This is Judith Counts. You're here now with the Senate General Government Committee. We have you on speakerphone, and I'm just going to go ahead and introduce the measure, and then Senator George, who's serving as our chair today, will start through the witness list.
Senator George who?
Senator
that's the last
Gary
name.
George.
Okay, thank you.
She's not the first person that did that. Go ahead, Judith.
Thank you, Mr. Chair members. House Bill 2030A requires state agencies to follow standards adopted by the state treasurer regarding electronic funds transfer. It authorizes state agencies to adopt rules allowing agencies to make payments by electronic funds transfer, and it also prohibits agencies from requiring a payee to open a bank account as a condition of receipt of payment. We have a no revenue impact. I will call your attention to the fiscal impact we have received. It is not known which agencies would use the electronic funds transfer option, so therefore the expenditure at this point is indeterminate. However, the experience shows that in 2004 there were 2.9 million unemployment insurance checks issued. The agency made 481,000 direct deposits, and those cost a dollar apiece for those transfers, and approximately 23,000 transfers to debit cards. There, the cost is 8 cents per transfer, which comes out in combination to approximately $483,000, just to give you a ballpark there. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay, we're ready for her then. Mm-hmm. Okay, go ahead and proceed.
Are you ready for me?
Yes, we're ready.
Oh,
thank
okay.
you very much.
I'm having a little difficulty hearing.
All right, we'll talk a little quick.
Senator George and committee members, my name is Deborah DeLong. I'm Mountain County Clerk in Vail, Oregon. And I would like to thank you for allowing me to testify by phone today. I would like to voice my support for the A and Growth version of House Bill 2030, with the amendment that allows the state to make payments by check without penalty for those of us who are not currently set up to accept electronic payments. This amendment is endorsed by the County Clerks Association and will save counties the expense of new finance receipting programs for their counties that are not set up for electronic payments. And that is, you know, basically my version of how I feel about this bill.
Any questions?
No, that's good.
Okay, sounds great. Anything else you wanted to say for the good of the order? Is it beautiful? Is it beautiful
no,
and sunshiny over there?
I appreciate you taking the time to listen to me, and so I didn't have to drive that distance.
Very good. I mean, the electronic transfer, and now we've used this. So.
Electronic.
Any questions, Senator Watson?
No.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank
Did you.
You
want to stay on with us as we.
Would you like to keep connected with us while we finish the hearing on this bill, or do you need to get on to other things?
Well, I carpool, and I have a person waiting to go home.
Okay.
So unless you have questions, I'd be glad to answer those. I would just as soon. Cut off.
No okay. question. Have fun on the ride.
Okay.
All right.
Thank you.
Goodbye.
Bye.
Now, Darren Bond is going to come up, the treasurer.
Was there any questions? She was in the mountains somewhere.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Darren Bond, the Director of Finance for the Oregon State Treasury. House Bill 2030 is designed to reduce the number of checks written by state agencies. In fiscal year 2004, state agencies wrote approximately 9 million checks and warrants. They wrote the same during that same period of time, they generated about 3.2 million electronic funds transfers. Our goal will be to see those numbers reversed. The Department of Human Services has calculated that it costs them about 64 cents to produce and distribute a check. It costs them about 7 cents per ACH transaction. With ACH electronic funds transfers, there's also greatly reduced administrative costs, which can dwarf the hard costs of a check. With ACH payments, there are no internal control issues around check stock, check signers, or redeemed checks. There's no lost checks, stolen checks. We don't have check fraud. House Bill 2030 allows an agency, by rule, to establish programs that rely on electronic funds transfers as the primary means of payment. At the same time, House Bill 2030 prohibits an agency from requiring that a payee open a bank account as a condition of payment. Instead, an agency could enroll a payee in a program that would issue them a payment mechanism known as an electronic payment card or a stored value card. With a stored value card option, payees who don't have a bank account or who choose not to use a bank account would receive a Visa-branded payment card. The card would allow free access to funds through a limited number of bank teller or ATM transactions and unlimited point-of-sale transactions at vendors. Benefits to the payee include no check cashing fees, no need to carry large amounts of cash, and access to funds at literally millions of merchants worldwide and about 74,000 here in the state of Oregon. The benefit to the agency is that the payments would be made via ACH, and they'd be able to enjoy the cost advantages that provides. The Employment Department estimates that it would enjoy biennial savings of approximately $3.5 million. The bill was amended in the House to clarify that agencies could not penalize someone who was unable to receive an electronic funds transfer, which was the county clerk's concern that they just voiced. Additionally, it was amended to prohibit the Department of Revenue from requiring that certain payments and receipts be made electronically. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Senator Walker.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. I was curious about the Department of Revenue issue because I was thinking, Mr. Bond, that, Mr. Bond, James Bond. I bet you got that lot.
I've heard of him.
When you were growing up. But you're Darren. Anyway, Vicki.
My grandfather was James.
Your grandfather was James? There you go. Somebody in the family, the real James Bond, please stand up. Anyway, I noticed that you took out the Department of Revenue in the House, but I'm looking at your testimony, and you said that it costs 64 cents to do a check the regular way and 7 cents by ACH. Why can't we mail these kicker checks by this electronic fund transfer and save ourselves a bunch of money?
Mr. Chair, Senator Walker, I didn't take out the Department of Revenue on the House side.
But the House did.
The House did. I believe it was specifically referencing certain types of payment accounts, and I think the concern was that if an electronic payment is made, there's also the ability by rule to access that payment and reverse it out. And I think that was felt to be an intrusion on the part of the Department of Revenue into personal accounts, and it was felt that that wasn't appropriate. I really was peripheral to that discussion, and so I'd probably need to ask you to talk to the Department of Revenue for further clarification on that, because it wasn't a Treasury issue.
I see. Mr. Chair, it does say in the bill that it's for payment for estimated tax, which is something that I usually do, but I haven't in the last couple of years because I haven't made enough money working here. Or tax due on your return or for a refund of overpayment. So most people who just filed on April 15th, if they had a tax due or a refund due, they now can't get that through electronic transfer because it was taken out of the bill.
Mr. Chair, Senator Walker.
We couldn't anyway.
They couldn't require it. It still okay. could be a voluntary program whereby the department allowed it to happen at the taxpayer's choice, but they couldn't require that they pay or receive payment electronically.
Okay. Well, Mr. Chair, I just remember a discussion. It was either in 99 or the 01 session about how much money it costs to mail out these kicker checks, and it's a heck of a lot of money, and I just wish that we would do that as a credit or some kind of value card or something like this program to save that kind of money, because clearly from the testimony of Mr. Bond, we're going to save $3.5 million for the Employment Department. That is not chump change.
Mr. Chair, Senator Walker, it costs about $1 million per kicker.
Per kicker? Well, thank you very much. Well, I like the bill. I just wish we could go further with it.
Okay. Any further questions for Mr. Bond? Senator Berger?
Mr. Chair, didn't I just vote against a bill very similar to this yesterday? I mean, it sounds like exactly the same bill on the floor of the Senate yesterday. Am I?
Don't know. Senator, what?
Yeah. You were thinking that they were going to load that card, and 3 years from now we'd take the money back.
No, but there was a bill on the floor of the Senate yesterday that was just sounds exactly like this bill, and I'm trying to think. Senator Johnson voted against it. I voted against it. Senator Schrader voted against it.
Is that gift cards? Was that having to do with gift cards?
Oh.
Sounded a lot like the bill. One thing that does bother me, Mr. Bond, is that when you filed the bill, you did not clarify that people would not be penalized who were unable. That had to be amended in the House. Or did you amend it?
Mr. Chair, Senator Berger, that language was brought forth by the county clerks and put in at the direction of the chair on the House side. There was no provision in the bill before that there could be any penalty. Therefore, no agency had the authority to charge such a penalty, but it was felt because the county clerks had that concern that we would further clarify the law and explicitly call that out. So we never contemplated a penalty, and again, there wasn't the provision for that beforehand. This is just a further clarification that such was not the intent. And if I might, I believe that the gift card issue is relative to the idea of money that's left on gift cards being transferred to the Commons.
I'm sorry, that was a joke on my part. Okay. I knew she knew. All right. Senator Berger, do you have a follow-up question?
No, I don't think so, Mr. Chair. There's something about some of this that I just am not quite sure. I like the money savings part of it. But there's just a part of it that I don't like. And one of the things that really bothers me is that in my district, we have a lot of retired people. Many of them, and I don't know how many, I wish I did know exactly how many, have access to computers and are computer literate and use electronic filing, and how many do not. But I do not ever want us to be in a position that people are penalized and that those who know or can afford go to the front of the line. And I'm just opposed to that kind of theory. I might have computers, and that's great, and all my children have computers, but everybody in the world doesn't have a computer. And everyone doesn't particularly want to be involved in this kind of transfer of money. So,
Mr. Chair and Senator Berger, I think you get a card. You get like a debit card. Mm-hmm.
Oh, yeah.
So there's I don't know that how a computer is involved in that.
Well, maybe I don't understand the process. Maybe you should explain the process to me.
Mr. Chair, Senator Berger, Senator Walker is correct. In the instance that's contemplated, the example that we gave of the stored value cards, if someone didn't have a bank account or chose to not have their benefits deposited directly to their existing bank account, they would be assigned a debit card. And they could take that debit card. They don't need any computer or anything. They can use it to access balance information, et cetera, but they don't need it. And they can take that card to any bank that does a Visa cash advance, and they can get the full value of that card out at that moment free of charge.
So I understand that part. I understand those are the mm-hmm. people that get the debit card, but everybody doesn't get a debit card.
No. It's their choice. If they'd like the money deposited directly to their bank account, that's absolutely that's what we would prefer. If they choose not to, then we can issue them a card, which provides some of the benefits of the card. We have Oregon has a very large unbanked population that are unable to be banked because of their credit history, because of their past experience with banks. This will help mainstream that, you know, those people and get them back into the, you know, into the banking world and the advantages that we get by carrying that debit card with us and being able to access their funds, not have to carry a big wad of cash around, and be able to go to any Visa merchant anywhere in the world and access their funds that they have on deposit by virtue of this program.
I have automatic deposits made in my bank account right now. I understand automatic deposits, but that's not my concern. But anyway, Mr. Chair, don't let me dominate this conversation.
Mr. Chair?
Senator Walker.
Well, I think one of the benefits of having the debit card, so to speak, is that these people don't have to get checks and go to a check cashing company that charges them money to cash their check. So, because isn't that the case now, Mr. Bond?
Mr. Chair, Senator Walker, that's absolutely correct.
Yeah, and this unbanked population, which is pretty huge, a lot of the Latino population or people who are just have bad credit or just don't want to bank at a bank, that's currently what they do to have to cash a check is go to one of these check cashing places. So I think this keeps them from having to do that, saves them money, and saves the state money.
Mm-hmm. I'll be teaching some discipline, too, if we draw all that money out at once and find out we're short later. We have, Darren, you were the only one signed up to testify on this bill. Is there anyone else who would like to testify on House Bill 2030? Okay. Is the committee satisfied with the bill?
We are. Yeah.
Okay. Then I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2030, and with the tap of the gavel, we'll open up a work session on House Bill 2038. Pleasure of the committee.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2030A to the floor of the Senate with a do-pass recommendation.
Senator Walker has moved House Bill 2030A to the floor with a do-pass recommendation. Is there any discussion or opposition?
Mr. Chair, I'm going to give you a courtesy vote to get it out of committee and reserve the right to vote how I want on the floor.
Okay. Very good. Would you like to record that, or should we go ahead and call the roll?
It doesn't matter. Okay. That's just fine.
Without objection, you're okay there? Okay. Is that without objection? Very good. Thank you very much. Now I'm going to close the work session on House Bill 2038. As soon as we get a carrier, and that's going to be Senator Walker, do you want to do that?
Sure.
Okay. And where are we going now, Judith?
Well, I think at this point I can move our way down the list. And
you want to go to 92?
2092.
All right. We're going to open up a public hearing on House Bill 2092A. You just tell us where we are.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. House Bill 2092A exempts annuity-issuing activities by charitable entities from the insurance code when those entities meet minimum financial and organizational requirements. Requirements include minimum net assets of $300,000, continuous operation, or affiliation with a charitable organization that has been in continuous operation for at least 5 years, and a separate and distinct trust fund that meets the future payments of all outstanding annuity agreements. It requires charitable organizations to meet the minimum financial and organization requirements to disclose in writing to donors that gift annuities are not issued by an insurance company and are not subject to regulation by the state of Oregon and are not protected when an insurance guarantee association. We have received a no fiscal and no revenue impact on the measure. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay, we have four people signed up. Sharon Hogan, OSU Founders. Is that Summerfield?
It looks like it's me, Summerfield.
Okay. All right. And Mr. and Mrs. Summerfield, I can't figure out what it is. Come on up. And we have three chairs up there, and John McDonald. with a simple name like Gary George, I write so poorly that they still ask me, what does that say? I said, the wild chicken with dirty feet.
Sorry. Chair George and distinguished senators, by way of introduction, I am Mr. Pete Sommerfeld.
Mr.
And I'm one of the associate directors of plan giving at the Oregon Health and Science University Foundation. My colleagues and I come before you today as representatives of nonprofit organizations across the state of Oregon. We are here to support House Bill 2092 because it will enable the state government to operate more efficiently and provide charities the ability to fulfill their mission in an efficient and responsible manner. The tax deduction provided by the federal and state tax codes recognizes the importance of this type of philanthropy in the United States. Donors can support the charity of their choice by means of an immediate gift of cash, stock, real estate, tangible personal property, or any variety of assets. However, especially for older citizens, the possibility of making a charitable gift while receiving a life income can meet a number of practical needs as well as aid the charity's mission. These deferred gifts provide immediate benefits to the donor and defer the charity's benefit or use of the funds until, as we say in the business, the gift matures.
Peter, I'm going to do a Frank Shields here. We like this bill, and we have the written testimony. Okay. Would you like to abbreviate that, and we'll move along?
I can abbreviate as quickly as you would like me to.
Conclusion. Yeah, great bill.
I like the conclusion of his testimony.
All right, yes. Well, if you don't want to hear from anything more from me, I can.
But you're advocating for the passage of this bill. I got
absolutely
that
we are. Okay. Absolutely we are.
All right. Now, you do not be intimidated by that, you guys. But we do have a workload.
Well,
and
if you
don't mind
doing it this way,
and we move it out.
Working smarter, not harder, is the way to go.
All right. And that's what you were saying.
Absolutely.
Go ahead.
Chair George, members of the committee, my name is John McDonald O'Lear. I'm the development director at Merrillhurst University, but I'm also president of the Northwest Plan Giving Roundtable, which is the local affiliate of the National Committee on Plan Giving. So we're kind of the local trade group in terms of charitable plan giving. And on behalf of our organization, I'm here to support this bill.
Good job. Sharon?
Thank you, Chair George and committee members. I'm Sharon Hogan. I'm the plan giving director for the Oregon State University Foundation. We're the fundraising arm for Oregon State University. I've been the director of plan giving there since 2001. Prior to that, I was with the plan giving director position with the Salvation Army. We also support Bill 2092, and I think that one of the benefits of it is that it will allow charitable institutions that now are unable to issue gifts and annuities to do so while still protecting the public. And also, I think it can be a money saver in that charities that are issuing gift annuities can then provide services which otherwise would have to be paid for by the state. That concludes my testimony.
Any questions for the three of them?
I think the only thing, I like the bill very much. I think the only thing that I like is just that we reassure the public that we're not throwing out regulations and to have it just kind of a carte blanche. People are just going to do whatever. So I think they're used to a certain amount of regulation, and this is relieving some of that, making it easier, making it a smoother process. And I understand it and like it, but I just want to be sure that in our dialogue here today that we make it very clear that we still have safety nets here for people that want to give charitable gifts. There's always this little fraud that lingers around that type of thing. And that's not what we're talking about today at all. So that's the reason I bring it up. If you'd like to just make some statements to clarify that for the record, I'd really appreciate it.
Chair George, Senator Verger, we totally agree with your comments. And in fact, when we had the opportunity to sit down with the insurance division and talk about what those requirements would be for the charities that could issue gift annuities in light of the changes in this bill, I think we were equally in favor of making sure that those would protect the public, that credible charities would be the ones issuing these gifts.
And I'd address that also in our session that we had when we worked with actually the insurance division prior to submitting this bill. We talked about the fact that we as nonprofit organizations actually wanted an organization to be in existence for a number of years, which would help guarantee that only institutions which had already proven themselves to be steady organizations that weren't going to go under, for instance, the next day. And in addition to that, we also feel that the audit requirements that are in this bill will provide the public with the necessary safeguards that they need.
Thank you.
We're going to hear a little bit more about that right now. Let's bring up the insurance administrator.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, for the record, Joel Ariel, Insurance Administrator with the Department of Consumer and Business Services. Respecting the time here, I'll be extremely brief as well. I think Senator Verger spoke to exactly the important issues from our perspective. We brought this issue as a regulatory streamlining initiative because the regulation we were engaged in we didn't think was ultimately necessary to protect consumers. We were getting no consumer complaints in this area, and the regulation just didn't seem necessary to us. We think the bill was strengthened in the House with the consultation and help of the folks that spoke just ahead of me, and as they suggested, they had some suggestions to us to make sure that that safety net was firm and solid, and so we think it's a good bill, and we would encourage its passage.
Senator Verger, are you happy with that answer?
Oh, I'm very happy with that answer.
Particularly, yeah. I think it was important, too, what you know the participants have said was they wanted some strengthening requirement to be in there to make sure that we had something everyone could be proud of.
We need to regulate where there are consumer problems, and we need to streamline where there are not. And this is an area where there haven't been.
Right. Well, I appreciate how many of these streamlining bills we've been seeing this year, and I sense a really positive message to Oregonians. We're trying to make this thing more favorable. And you have to accomplish the goals.
Thank you.
Well, you know, Mr. Chair, charitable giving is a wonderful thing for the state of Oregon because that's the way so many things happen in the state that are not having to be funded by taxpayers. And people like to feel good about giving. And so I think that we just want to be sure that they have that process for giving money that they're protected and not misled. So, but I think it's wonderful.
Joel, thank you very much.
Thank you.
I'm going to go ahead and close the public hearing on House Bill 2092, and I'm going to slow down a little bit while we get the other member back here, and I'm going to open up a work session on House Bill 2092. When I slow down my speech, it's still too fast.
Mr. Chair.
With that, we have opened up a work session.
Move House Bill 2092 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Starr has moved House Bill 2092A as amended in the House to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any further discussion?
No, I missed Joel's testimony.
No, it was good.
I know. He was high. He's such a good guy. I really one of the best
again?
Employees in the department. No. I'll read it.
All right. Without objection, so moved. We need a carrier for this.
Well, I've already done two.
I know. Senator Verger, would you carry this? Because
sure.
That was an eloquent speech
sure.
You just made.
I'm happy to carry it.
Okay. We have a carrier. And so with that, I will... I don't think I closed the work session on House Bill 2092A. You want to just work down the list?
Sure.
Okay. 2192A?
Oh, wait.
Oh, yeah, sure. Right. All right, I'm going to open up a public hearing on House Bill 2118.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. House Bill 2118 provides for permanent public access to State of Oregon publications, regardless of whether they are formally printed or posted on agency websites. It creates a digital state documents repository built on existing investment in hardware and software made under the state's e-government program. It directs the state library to create a catalog of records for all state documents, printed or electronic, and to make the catalog available to all Oregon libraries. It reduces the number of copies of printed documents that state agencies and the Legislative Assembly must provide to the state library. We have a no revenue and minimal fiscal impact on the measure. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
All right. Jim and Mike, come on up. Boy, look at them hustle. They're really
nice candy.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Jim Shepke. I'm the state librarian, the director of the state library. House Bill 2118, excuse me, I didn't give my testimony.
Okay. Now take your time. We weren't as big as a rush. I think I stampeded the herd here.
Okay. Mr. Chair, House Bill 2118 was introduced by the governor on behalf of the State Library Board, and it saves money, a little bit of money, and it solves a problem. The problem is that for many years the State Library has endeavored to collect every document printed by state agencies, and we've done that for 100 years. But recently, in order to save money, agencies have been just posting documents to their websites and never printing them. And all the statutes dealing with this assume that the documents will be printed. So if they're not printed, we don't get them. Sometimes we do, but not necessarily. So what this bill does is it requires every agency to make all their documents available, whether they're printed or not printed. And what it also does is it reduces the number of printed documents that are required by law to be deposited with the state library. Currently, any document printed by a state agency has to be deposited with the state library anywhere from 15 to 30 copies. We're going to reduce that down to 10 copies in order to save about $35,000 biennium. And then we're also going to create a digital documents repository using the existing investment that we've already made in the e-government software. And Mike Fries from the DAS IRMD is here to tell you about that today.
The digital copy would be in addition to the 10?
Yes. Okay. Every document would be deposited in this new digital repository. And we've designed that. We planned this for the last 2 years in such a way that that won't be an additional workload on the agencies. It won't be a fiscal impact on the state library or the agencies. So we think this is a very good idea. We're very fearful that we're going to lose the history of state government if agencies just post documents to their website, never print them, they never come to the state library. Someday the agencies may take them off their website and then they're gone. And so what we're trying to do here is to continue the historical role of the state library of preserving the history of state government, and this bill will do that.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Mike Fries, Deputy State Chief Information Officer, also happened to be the state printer, which coincidentally is a constitutional office. That's an interesting topic of conversation for another day. Mm-hmm. But we have been involved with the state library dealing with this issue that Jim described. And the class of documents, the digital ones in particular, are termed in some cases born digital. They never see the light of day on paper unless somebody chooses to print them out locally, and they die digitally. They disappear, and there is, in fact, a class of documents. This is not unique to Oregon state government. It's a much larger problem that have been birthed and disappeared without any record being created of them. This helps begin to solve that problem. It does so also by making use of an existing investment in the e-government platform. So that's why you see a trivial cost impact, because we're making use of an existing investment. It's just a smart way to handle this problem. So we'll continue to work with Mr. Shepke on implementation. Again, make use of the existing platform, and we'll solve a problem at very little expense.
Very good. Any questions for Jim or Mike? Senator Berger?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. What if you don't get your grant for $80,000?
I can address that, Mr. Chair. Senator Berger, we are hopeful to get a grant from the Library of Congress to help us with implementation planning. We're going to attend a training and send a couple of staff members to a training in a couple of weeks that's paid for by the Library of Congress. They're trying to see that all states address this problem, and they're addressing the problem at the federal level. So we're all working together. We're all sharing best practices. So my staff is going to attend this training, and then we're hopeful that we'll get this grant. If we don't get the grant, we have a very clear idea of how to proceed with this project. We've met for the past 2 years with Mike and his staff, and we're pretty certain we know how to do it. So if we don't get the grant, we'll just forge ahead.
Follow up, Mr. Mayor. Follow up. What is the total cost of creating this depository?
The cost is, I think I'd let Mike address that, if you would.
Mr. Chair, Senator Verger, most of the cost is already what we would call sunk cost, is expended to create the e-government platform. So the real cost associated with establishing the depository is the planning work that Jim was just talking about and the implementation using that existing platform. We're not going to have to go out and buy additional software or hardware to be able to support this. At some point, if we're incredibly successful, years in the future when we have hundreds of thousands of documents, we would then be looking at increasing the storage capacity, but that would happen anyway as we begin to use the government platform. So it's very minimal, and it's what we call kind of an in-kind contribution cost of just doing the planning and then implementing on the existing platform.
Follow up, Mr. Chair.
Mm-hmm.
So the $80,000 is, that's probably the total cost?
That's intended for planning.
Mr. Chair, Senator Berger, that is the total cost. We will use our existing staff, our existing hardware and software. We know how to do it, and so this is going to work very well.
Mike, you mentioned the storage. Is that going to be electronic storage?
Mr. Chair, that's correct. It will be electronic storage, and that data does get backed up, so in the event of an emergency, we can restore it.
Yes. Well, that's good news. That's going to get cheaper. We can tell that already. Any further questions?
The faster the better.
Faster the better. All right. Thank you two very much. Very interesting idea. House Bill 2118, I'm going to close the public hearing, and we're going to open up a work session on House Bill 2118.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Walker.
I would move House Bill 2118 to the floor of the Senate with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Walker has moved House Bill 2118 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any further discussion? Without objection. So moved.
I'll carry it, Mr. Chair.
All right. Thank you. Are we going to 2194?
192.
Oh, 92. Yes. Yep. Thank you very much. All right. I'm going to open up a public hearing on House Bill 2192A.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. House Bill 2192A exempts a state employer from continuing health coverage for an employee on military leave if the employee's leave is with the Active Guard Reserve Program. It extends the time period for agency health plan coverage for public employees subject to involuntary military call-up from up to 12 months, and the extension is for up to 24 months. We have a no revenue impact. I will point out that we do have a fiscal impact on this measure. And again, this measure is the one that's eliminating basically the state's statutory requirement for dual coverage of health benefits.
Mm-hmm.
It has a couple of components here, and I'll just highlight for you. The fiscal impact, although it's indeterminate, the impact is estimated to be equivalent to the per employee and per month flexible benefit package paid by state agencies. So the actual savings will depend on kind of what their flexible benefit package looks like. That ranges from $652 to $1,017, depending on if they have a spouse and family, that sort of thing. The Department of Administrative Services states that in order to identify and track these future AGR members that would be covered, that cost of reprogramming the database would be a one-time cost of $18,600. And then Legislative Fiscal did point out that under this measure, it would only be, of course, when consecutive tours beyond 12 months occur for soldiers that have a spouse or a partner or children. And so that results in, and since the Public Employees Benefit Board has determined that approximately 33 employees might fall under this category, given those assumptions, the fiscal impact is estimated to be approximately $149,000 for the 05-07 biennium and $197,000 for the 07-09 biennium. Based on 33 soldiers. And, of course, the cost by fund type depends on what the source of the revenue is the state agency is using to pay those benefits. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Judith, I'm going to ask this question. I know the answer, it wouldn't have come from the House. It would have had this impact. None of our committed troops and their families are going to have less coverage. Do we have an answer to that? Because we have no one signed up.
It would be my understanding, and actually, and they do address this in the fiscal impact. Again, we're just, it's my understanding, we're just eliminating, they make a distinction between the Active Guard Reserve Program and the Oregon National Guard and Reservists.
Right.
So that's the first distinction. It's my understanding that, and even on your fiscal impact in the first paragraph of the comments, you're seeing that the measure, since it eliminates the state statutory requirement for dual coverage,
right.
we're talking that about just not providing coverage that they will be receiving from the federal government,
mm-hmm.
and the fiscal impact that we see does apply if they have a spouse, partner, or children, that the state would continue to pick up those costs.
Right, right. I think the Walker's going to be right back.
I don't know where he went, but Mr. Chair, we're discussing the fiscal impact of this bill.
Right.
It seems to me that the bill's got to go to Ways and Means based on the assumptions that the analyst makes in the bill, in the fiscal statement.
Well, everything here is savings, right?
No.
Is it savings?
Yes. That's why the scheme of the fiscal measure is estimated to be.
It says the cost. The cost by fund type would depend upon the source of funding for the soldiers employing agency or government entity. And so they're assuming the fiscal impact is estimated to be $148,697
mm-hmm.
based on 25 soldiers and then $196,3832 based on 33 soldiers in the 0709. So there is a cost. I don't know how this didn't go to Ways and Means.
Mr. Chair, members, I think there's a couple things going on here, and perhaps someone from fiscal would we can certainly get them down here to walk through it very carefully for you. A couple things going on. There is, if you look on the first page of the fiscal, the last paragraph, they're talking about an indeterminate amount of savings because
right.
they are reducing kind of double duty on the health insurance coverage. So when the federal government is picking up that soldier's health benefits, then the state is not required to also provide that coverage for them. So there's some savings there. And then, yes, Senator Walker was correct in pointing out that there's also a cost in that and the cost would be associated with, if you look on the second page of the fiscal, the third paragraph mm-hmm. in the bottom, they talk about how the fiscal would be generated, and that is for soldiers that are serving more beyond the 12 months and they have a spouse, partner, or child. That's how this fiscal impact right there, it says, is generated that you see below, and that is because we are still making sure family is covered.
But we would have them on board now, correct? And so there would be no additional cost. Can we get someone down here? Let's go ahead and we'll close the public hearing. We'll
yes.
reopen this.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
The fiscal officer is John Borden.
Okay. We'll bring him down here.
Can you hear John? Okay.
Yeah.
All right.
It says it's going to cost $18,600 for gas to set up the system.
Right. Right.
Which is kind of minimal.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's really, yeah. All right. I'm going to go ahead and close temporarily the public hearing on House Bill 2192A. Where do you want to go next? Right over there.
She's going to open them out. We've had a request to open these two together because they're connected and there's some
okay.
testimony. That's
what you're in the blind spot of my glasses. What do we have?
2216 and 2219.
All right. And so open both of them as a public hearing.
Yeah.
All right. At this time, I'm going to open a public hearing on two bills, House Bill 2116A.
22.
What did I say? 2216A. Right. And 2219.
Right. Yes, while we're waiting for fiscal, we'll go ahead on these two measures. House Bill 2216A specifies that existing laws covering disclosures to manufactured dwelling buyers and contracting requirements related to space improvements apply to rented lots and manufactured dwelling subdivisions. It makes dealers or park owners that contract to make improvements to the dwelling owner's site responsibility for completion of the work. It moves the deadline forward for providing the buyer an estimate of costs, and it requires contractors who provide cost estimates for improvements to comply with contractor bidding statutes. On that particular measure, we have both a no revenue and a no fiscal impact. Related measure, House Bill 2219, adds current unlawful trade practices of a manufactured dwelling dealer to the list of those unlawful practices that may be prosecuted by the Attorney General or a district attorney, and it includes misrepresentations to buyers and lenders regarding financing. On that measure, we have a no revenue and a minimal fiscal impact. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Marilyn and John, you guys want to come on up and let's talk about these two?
Let's make sure fiscal's on their way.
Okay.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
Chair George, members of the committee, my name is Marilyn O'Dell. I'm a senior assistant attorney general. I'm here on behalf of the financial fraud section. We have two bills before you today, 2216A and 2219. These both have to do with manufactured housing. In 2000, the Attorney General had a manufactured housing task force. There were a number of legislative measures that came out of that and that were passed by the Assembly in 2001. This is a technical fix on some of the things that were oversights when that was put together. House Bill 2216 addresses the disclosures that need to be given to prospective tenants about required park improvements and the costs of those improvements. The changes are that these disclosures apply to both spaces in manufactured dwelling parks as well as converted rental spaces that are in manufactured dwelling subdivisions. It also clarifies that the providers of site improvements include contractors, dealers, and landlords who contract with the buyer for improvements. Right now, it only covers contractors, but frequently landlords and dealers are actually in the middle and are the contracting party with the contractor to perform the improvements. Without specifically providing that the dealers and the landlords are covered under this, there's the recourse provisions are unclear for the tenant that they have recourse against the dealer or the landlord if they're the ones actually contracting to have the work done if it isn't done correctly. So that adds them to the group that are specifically made liable. It also requires that the statement of estimated costs for improvements be delivered before any work commences under the contract for improvements. And the kind of improvements that we're talking about, there's frequently with these manufactured dwelling parks, the tenant is required to do what they call the park package improvements. Those can be $15,000 to $20,000. They include such things as sidewalks, underground utility connections, skirting, carports, garages, that sort of thing. So these are substantial costs, and we believe that it's important that all of those costs be known before any work begins. Another technical fix that has to do with the Unlawful Trade Practices Act. The 2001 legislation created unlawful trade practices related to disclosures by lenders about lending requirements. It was made actionable only by private parties. Now, this is an anomaly. There is no other unlawful trade practice in the 50 or so we have in the state of Oregon that's only actionable by a private party. It was just put into the wrong statute. It needs to be put into the amendment would put it into the list that the Attorney General and the district attorneys are authorized to bring, and then by reference, private parties can bring actions for those same unlawful trade practices. So it merely got put into the wrong statutes. We've been working on these bills with the Oregon Manufactured Housing Coalition, and John Brenneman is here to speak on their behalf.
Marilyn, let me ask you a question. You said amendment, but there are no amendments to this bill. You meant just the bill
itself. Just the bill itself.
As
I'm
the
sorry.
Amendment of the resolution.
That's correct.
Just want to clarify that.
Sorry. Chair George and members of the committee, I'm John Brenneman. I represent the Manufactured Housing Communities of Oregon, member of the aforementioned coalition on manufactured housing. It includes all kinds of people, including Don Miner, who was here until just a few minutes ago, who's executive director of Oregon Manufactured Housing Association. We worked with Marilyn, as she said. My client had some concerns that owners of park owners would maybe get roped in and need a contracting license if they were doing ordinary maintenance in the park. And Marilyn made it very clear on the record on the House side that that would not be the case. We're comfortable with 2216 at this point, and we can't endorse it. Don told me to tell you all that he loves them both.
He loves them both. This was a good work group. That's like when I hear when we talk about aggregate that the farmers are on board. I'm thinking there must be end of the world must be near.
Again, Marilyn O'Dell, Senator George, members of the committee, and also John Van Landingham, who represents the tenants and who's also part of the coalition, is also here if you have any questions that you'd like to address to him.
Senator, you know a lot about this subject. Are you happy?
I do. I declare a conflict of interest, potential conflict of interest. Exactly when she said $20,000, she got my attention about improvements. No, I have to tell you that Mr. Brenneman was responsible for helping me have a comfortable place to stay during my sessions in the legislature, so I'm indebted to him. But I really do think that both of the bills look fine. I don't see anything wrong with them. And having declared the conflict of interest, I still feel the same way.
And our Parks Association people are okay. And Marilyn, we're going to ask you to nod your head one more time that, in fact, the park owners are not going to have to get a contractor's license, if I understood that correctly.
Oh, kind of work that we're talking about is
right.
Maintenance, and that's specifically right. Addressed on page 3 of my testimony. As long as there's really a specific list of what are improvements. It's specified by statute, and the improvements are very much the kind that are strictly related to the setup and don't have anything to do with any ongoing maintenance that the park owners may be providing.
Okay.
Yes.
Everybody's happy.
Happy?
Happy.
Well, I'm going to go ahead and close the public hearing on House Bills 2216 and 2219. And I'm assuming we're going to get them back here. I'm going to go ahead and open. We have enough committee to pass this thing.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. All right. I'm going to open up a work session then on House Bill 2216.
Mr. Chair, move 2216A to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Starr has moved House Bill 2216 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any further discussion without objection? Would you like to carry this? If not, I can do it. Senator Berger?
Yeah. I don't mind doing that. I was just thinking, is 2216 amended, or does it come to us from the House, and it's just the A?
It is 2216, and I was reading it not amended, so we thank you for correcting that.
That's,
we are talking about in House Bill 2216A.
Uh-huh.
Okay? Without objection? Thank you very much for correcting that. And we will then move on to I'm going to close the work session on House Bill 2216, and we will open up a work session on House Bill 2219.
Mr. Chair,
Senator Starr.
Move House Bill 2219 to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Starr has moved House Bill 2219 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any further discussion? If not, without objection? So moved, and that is not an amended bill. Senator Berger, would you carry that one also?
Okay.
Very good. Now, what we're going to do is we're going to stand at ease for a couple of minutes. And let me first close the work session on House Bill 2219. And we'll stand at ease. Work session. Come on up, identify yourself for the record, and the question that we're asking is, with a fiscal in the range of $150,000, should it go to Ways and Means? And John, you're going to help us. Go ahead and state your name for the record and tell us about it.
Good afternoon. I'm John Borden with Legislative Fiscal Office. Chair George, at this time, some of the employees, the A and AGR employees, were not able to differentiate, and so this measure would not have to come to Ways and Means because we're not able to ascertain what state agencies these employees are with, and therefore unable to ascertain what budgets are impacted and their fund types.
Great.
So.
Okay.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, let me just get very clear that I understand this.
Right.
The purpose is that we don't want to double our coverage on someone
mm-hmm.
if they're already covered.
Right.
But these AGR, these reservists, are covered, but people that are just called up out of their job to go into the service are not necessarily covered except by the state. So now we are going to extend them to 24 months instead of 12. Is that?
Chair George and Senator Berger, that's my understanding, but the agency probably would best speak to that, but it is an extension of coverage from the 12 months.
For those that are just called up into the service and not the reservists, the regular guard reservists, because they're already covered, and they have insurance and health coverage.
Okay. We're in a work session. Is everyone comfortable with that answer?
I appreciate, Mr. Borden, I appreciate you coming and clarifying that for us.
Thank you.
Okay. Thanks very much. Pleasure of the committee.
Mr. Chair, I'd move House Bill 2192A to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Starr has recommended that we move House Bill 2192A is to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any further comment or question? Without objection? Seeing none? So moved. I'll close the work session on House Bill 2192A. And, Judith, we're going to go to... Oh, yes, we need a carrier.
Senator Verger, have you had any today?
She has. I can. I have it. I can
okay,
do that.
Okay, there you go.
Because I want to get an answer to this. So.
Who's going to do it?
I'll be happy to carry if you want me to carry. They're not going to all come up on the same day.
All right.
Okay. I wouldn't think.
Okay. You're the carrier. And, boss, Judith, where are we going now? Okay. And are you folks, do you want to shut down because we have the choice of doing that? We just have two bills left.
If there's two bills.
Mr. Chair, I have to catch a van to Lake Oswego at 5:30. I really need
at least
15 minutes to grab something to eat and get ready. So if we could get these punched out in 8 minutes.
Do you have any problem with either one of the remaining?
No.
Okay. So if you had to leave and no one signed up. All right. Okay, which one do you want to start with?
So, let's just, now, did you read?
Oh, boy, that's it.
Yeah, we did those two.
Okay,
yeah,
so here it is. We are.
Yeah. Yeah, okay. All right. We just will open as a work session, huh? Or do you need? Well, no, you need to read that. Yeah. All right. Don't hurry too fast. I'm going to open up a public hearing on House Bill 2253. You just don't worry. Tell us where we are.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. House Bill 2253 changes the term governmental unit to local government in the relevant statute here in order to conform with existing definitions. We have no revenue and no fiscal impact on the measure.
Mr. Chair,
yes,
I don't know why this wasn't in the Scrivener's bill, because it would have been a great one for that.
Right.
The relating clause, Senator Starr pointed out, is very tight. We can't really play with it. I think this is fine.
We have deja vu all over again, because I swear I saw a bill just recently that changed it from local government to government.
We're looking at too many bills.
That's probably it.
All right.
Are we in work session?
We're not, but I'm going to do that. Judith, have you finished?
That's right.
Okay, we're ready to move. I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2253, and we'll open up a work session on House Bill 2253.
Mr. Chair, I would move House Bill 2253 to the floor of the Senate with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Walker has moved House Bill 2253 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any further discussion? Without objection. So moved. I'm going to open it. Oh, I'm going to close the work session on House Carrier.
I'll carry that.
All right.
Okay.
Okay, and now we will close the work session on House Bill 2253, and we will open up a public hearing on House Bill 2259.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Our last bill of the day here, House Bill 2259, corrects an engrossing error made in the be engrossed version of House Bill 2341 from the 2003 legislative session. We have a no fiscal and no revenue impact on the measure. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
We cannot declare that we do not fail to meet our...
Changes the date, Judith?
That's correct.
Mm-hmm.
No, it doesn't change the date. The language requiring contracting agencies to enter into small procurement contracts, quote, in accordance with small procurement procedures established by rules adopted under ORS 279A.070 should have been omitted.
Oh, right. I was reading the wrong note there. That's...
Yeah.
Yep.
So there was language that should have been omitted.
So what should it say instead of March 1st, 2005?
Where did you get that?
That's the emergency clause. That's the emergency clause. That's the effective.
Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. I see what the question is now. What's happening there is it makes this change. That is, Senator Walker was exactly correct. If you look on the measure, it deletes language on lines 6 and 7, and that deletion will become effective March 1st, 2005, which, of course, we're already past that date, but that's just the effective date for this language change. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay.
I'll move it.
You will move it.
Senator Berger,
we're going.
Do you have any more questions?
Are we okay? Senator Berger.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
I'm going to. Whoa, hang on.
Yeah.
I need to close the public hearing on House Bill 2259. And with that, I will open up a work session on House Bill 2259. Senator
White. Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll move House Bill 2259 to the floor of Senate with a do-pass recommendation.
Senator Walker has moved House Bill 2259 to the floor with a do-pass recommendation. Is there any further discussion or without objection? Very good. Is there anything else that should come before the committee?
Yes.
Yes.
There is.
Carrier on that bill.
Yes, and that's going to be
but
your right. Oh, we did
that.
Right.
I need to relay a message from the chair. Okay. I am going to be bringing around to your offices some possible concepts for your consideration for the SAFE-related bills, that is particularly Senate Bill 310 and Senate Bill 984. And the chair would appreciate either you calling him, and I'll leave his cell phone number on those documents for you so you can talk to him directly about those concepts. He would like to have a discussion about those concepts. We are posted for Thursday. We're in a work session just on the three measures, those two and including Senator Walker, Senate Bill 1003. We're posted for work session to discuss all the concepts with respect to those three bills, and then we will move forward with a drafting request from that meeting. The only other thing I want to point out is when we meet on Thursday, we'll be meeting in room 357 because the committee before us in this room is having PGE, hearings, and in order to let them use the room, that's the one room left in the building for Thursday, so we will be meeting in 357.
So I'll be in this room with that committee.
Oh, where is 357?
I know.
It is the hearing rooms, you know, the two hearing rooms in the middle,
judiciary.
Going in between. Yeah,
judiciary. The House judiciary room. Gosh, it's been so long since I've been.
I know where 350 is. Tell me about. How far is it from
just
there?
Around the corner. Around the corner.
I missed the Senate bill number. It's 310, 984, and Senate bill something.
1003.
You'll be receiving
did
the
I,
concepts.
Did I close that work session?
Yes.
I thought I did. Okay.
Bills,
I'm going to carry it.
But the work session will also be on 1003 because I understand Senator Walker has some proposed language there to discuss.
Senate bill 1003 is not at all what it says on the bill. I mean, I just use that as a vehicle to stuff things into should I need that, and I needed it, so I've got three dash amendments to talk about on 1003.
All right.
There are bills that didn't get hearings in other committees when I felt they should.
Very good. Is if there's, not,
really,
if there's
really good.
Nothing to come before the committee, we will, at the top of the gavel, be adjourned.
Okay.
Thank you.